kind of the topics that the most of you have to go through in your life in the college or high school or graduate school or all of them, and get swallowed and be the end of the exam. On the other hand, I'm going to give you a little bit easier way of seeing protein biochemistry. And sorry, there are 50 some slides. I don't remember how many I made it, but I tried to make it as easy as possible. And why protein biochemistry is this? This is not a node of whatever networks. This is a common glycolysis and accompanied metabolic pathways. This is common, and it's about 500 reactions here. It's not a computer network anything. And individual points shows that there is one molecule, either substrate or product from the reaction. And you see everything in a cascade and branching out. And not only that, this bar, each bar signifies individual reaction. And unlike ordinary chemistry, we probably need one enzyme, unique enzyme per one reaction. Means just with this, you have this metabolism in probably every cell in your body. You have 500, at least to do this, 500 different proteins. So that's how many proteins what you needed. The common and the core. I'm not showing any weird or sideways of the metabolism reaction. This is just a core reactions and has 500. And just to do this, you need 500 enzymes to do this.
This is the mitochondria, right?
No. Both mitochondria inside and also cytoplasm, mostly in cytoplasm. And what you learned on your textbook on the glycolysis and citric acid cycle is this, that now here, embedded here, this is where the model of this acetyl-CoA pyruvate and all these molecules here. So that's how many enzymes you needed just to survive. That's what I want to show you. And even E. coli bacteria, this is E. coli again I'm showing you, has now we said it's about 5,000 proteins. As our resolution of separating proteins and such getting better and better, this number grows. We really don't know how many. And to do that, you need 500,000, this plus alpha number of the RNAs. But DNA is one. That's a master blueprint. And take a look at all the other molecules in comparison to number of the proteins. And for blueprint for this is messenger RNA are exceedingly bigger numbers in comparison to the others. Some proteins, E. coli, they have just one or two or five molecules per cell. You never know. But how many different proteins you need to survive is a lot. So how do they do that? That's the second part of the story. And the first thing is proteins. So what is proteins? So protein is a linear amino acid chain of what we call alpha amino acids. I'm gonna show you later. And they connect to each other by the bond of what we call peptide bond. It's a covalent linkage between carbonyl residues and ammonium residues next to each other, and they form this backbone, what we call peptide backbone. Here, what we call this is alpha carbon, and the carbonyl residue, amine residue, alpha carbon. Here is another carbonyl residue, and this is already the second amino acid, and third amino acid, and so on. And what you see is different side chains attached to these alpha carbons. Sometimes ring, sometimes enormously big, sometimes it has a charge, sometimes just merely just H or CH3. So difference in these side chains makes the each amino acid unique. And not only individual, what we call polypeptide is made with this way, many, many proteins actually are accumulation or multi-unit of this. For instance, this is hemoglobin, and it has a four subunits, in other words, different, made from four separate polypeptide chains. So protein could be one polypeptide chain or many, many polypeptide chains. Nonetheless, individual polypeptide is a linear sequence of amino acids, starting from amino terminal end, or we call it N-terminal, just because of that, to the carbonyl terminal end. And because of the synthesis sequence, we name this amino acid as a first amino acid always, from N-terminal, amino terminal. That's the, we say, direction. Or so, I may say upstream or downstream today means that they're saying upstream of this amino acid is this. That's always the case. It could be any other amino acid. You can make chemically better amino acids or any other modifications of amino acids. But so far, all the animals use 20 different alpha amino acids. That's only what we use. And here's the different size difference of the proteins. This is even not small enough. It's cytochrome C, one of these oxidative phosphorylation chain, 1300, about 100 amino acids. Whereas chitin, this is a muscle, thin filament, thick filament connecting proteins. And this is about 3 million Dalton. And this is known single largest polypeptide chain in human or mammalian cells. Many, many proteins, as I said, that there is a complex with many amino acids. So total number of the amino acids or total molecular weight may be bigger than this, or even much bigger than this. But giving single amino acid chains, as interrupted, chitin is the, what we said is the biggest. And we always classify this level of the structure in amino acid in four different groups, or four different levels. First one is called primary structure. It's just a linear sequence of amino acid. You spell out from this lysine to histidine, like this. And when they're synthesized, particular amino acid sequences, most likely many of them takes a natural shape. This is spiral shape, but called alpha helix. And from this to this transition is automatic because of the charges and every environment as soon as they started to take place. Unless you disturb or other amino acid comes and disturb, it takes natural secondary structures. And while you continue to synthesize this polypeptide chain, which I will talk about in the second hour, some of them, some of the sequence, because of the charge or side residues, they failed to make this amino acid structure called alpha helix. So they started to make other free regions, continue by with another alpha helix, for instance, here and that. And then you start to take the unique shape of this protein or polypeptide, which we call this tertiary structure. Tertiary structure could be formed by itself or needs some assistance. I don't talk about it second hour, but this to this requires a little bit of the assistance sometimes. And then giving this, all this tertiary structure of this peptide chain, many, many proteins like this, looks like a hemoglobin, comes all together, four similar subunits come together, and make the hollow protein, what we call tertiary structure protein. I did not write that you this information in your note or anywhere, but for the many proteins to function, not only for peptide chains or accompanied sugar or whatever lipid, but also you need coenzyme and cofactors, many times. Coenzymes is plus equal to vitamins. Coenzyme is a small organic molecule. Definition of coenzyme is small organic molecule and does not take being metabolized like a vitamin. And the cofactor, typical cofactors are ions, magnesium, calcium. And together with all small alkaloids, in this case, it's not written, but the heme, which is iron binding, yes, cap.
You might also mention that a molecule is missing from here to water.
Water, yes, that comes later. Very important thing, so, yes. So all this range, we consider different levels of structure. So we're gonna essentially step up this ladder. And I'm gonna show you that water, love to hate water, of course. And all this we use is amino acid, I told you, is alpha amino acid, because this blue carbon is a key carbon, what we call alpha carbon, attached one arm with amino group, the other carbonyl group, and hydrogen, and something. That this something makes this individual amino acids unique. And number one, and there are still chemistry, which I'm very, very bad. I can't distinguish it right all the time. But if you buy many experimental, you buy amino acids to do some experiment, you get L and the D mixtures because it's very difficult to separate each other. But somehow biology uses almost exclusively, special animal cells use L form of amino acid. So by accident, you bought just D only form of this amino acid. Yes?
The L form versus the D form, is the L form defined as the one that animals use?
Wait. Oh no, it's a stereochemistry.
Where does the definition of L versus D come from?
Left or right rotation.
That's not because of this, animal use or any biological purposes.
Okay.
Pure chemical. Always the use of, I have experienced that one of my students bought a chemistry and this is highly pure chemical to do some competitive inhibitions with amino acid and says D something. I don't think it works. And on the other hand, interestingly, for the sugars, the glucose and such, we use D form of this. D form of the sugars, not L form of the sugars. Somehow, nature's decided that way. And don't ask me why not D or L. It's something that do you know why? And nature decided at the beginning, I guess.
All right, if I knew, I forgot.
And also we have 20 some amino acids, and we classified amino acids according to this polarity charges and the charges. Polarity means whether able to make water binding, in other words, hydrogen bond at the biological sounds pH, like in 7 or so. That we call polarity. In other words, non-polar amino acid cannot make a hydrogen bond or hydrophobic amino acid, another way of saying it. And also no dead charge. If it has a charge, you can make some bond bindings. So that's one group of amino acid, hydrophobic amino acid. And then there are polar amino acid. It's polar, but the net charge is neutral, so it's uncharged. Or extra positive charge, or has extra negative charge. I know it's boring talk in the morning. And you think, I've learned this 5 times, 10 times during my school life. But
you can never hear it often.
Right. But, you know, I know, you know, as soon as you finish the exam, it goes away. You get a fever brain somehow. Have to come back next on the next class. And here's the amino acid, individual amino acid with it. Now, first is non-polar ones. And the aliphatic amino acid means, it means it's like a, these kind of carbon chains, not necessarily anything for us, for me, at least. And the important thing is, they are pretty much hydrophobic amino acid and smaller ones. And another important thing is always I was asked to non-biology people is, what's the difference of name and this abbreviations? And we use either these three-letter abbreviations, which I prefer, or one-letter abbreviations. And three letters make sense to me because it more says directly what it is. And one letter, now this somehow non-polar aliphatic amino acid, one letter most likely corresponds to first letter of that name of the amino acid. However, it goes to like this, glutamine. Q. It's no Q in here. Don't look for the Q. Sometimes, you know, we have to make it. It's always because it's overlapping letters all the time. All right, go back to here. Among these, proline is unique. As you see, it has this ring structure with these amino residues here. And of course, this has to go attaching with other amino acids. That's a backbone, consists the backbone of the polypeptide chains. But this ring structure can be isomerized. I think I have a picture. So that isomerization makes a little bit of different features. Namely, different angles in these polypeptide chains. That is one of the problems, or factors disturbing forces making of alpha helices.
So the ring stays, if you make a polypeptide, this ring will stay, or does it open up when you want it to stay?
Still unattaches, yes.
Yeah.
As long as my textbook says. And the second one is, now it's polar. Polar means this CH, or this CH here is OH, or here's a cysteine sulfur bond here, this CH, can make hydrogen bond with the water. So this molecule are easier to get into the water or easily dissolved into the buffer. The other ones, most of them, it's difficult to put it to dissolve in the water, so naturally what I use is either DMSO or something to make into the solution. Third one here now has extra charge. Here you have positive charge, and histidine has this structure, funny structure, ring structure, gives you a positive charge. And negative charge amino acids are both just the version of extra carbonyl residues here. Histidine, NH, and this has, I believe that the one consistent free estrogen donor or something. Accepting that free rings. Histidine binds many things for that reason. It's not exactly still chemistry I can draw right away in this blackboard, yeah, sorry, but there.
Helen, can you go back to the point? You're going to talk about the tyrosine.
What?
Just go to the next slide.
I was
waiting for that, the other tyrosine.
Yeah. And then, finally, this real ring structure, phenol type ring structure, or aromatic groups with amino acids. And phenylalanine and tryptophan are neutral, and then this has OH, so, but this is said to be neutral. Amino acid classified as neutral amino acid, tyrosine. And practically speaking, we use this amino acid as a marker for UV absorbers, especially tryptophan. This ring structure absorbs UV structure. That's why you use ultraviolet, like 280 nanometers, to measure the protein concentrations. Yes?
Yeah, the point I was going to bring up was yesterday, the lecture talked about phosphorylation and tyrosine kinase that came up.
Yeah.
Do you want to say something about phosphorylation and why that amino acid side group is important?
Yes, on the phosphorylation that the this OH is carried to and phosphate, terminal phosphate. I don't have reaction itself in what's inside, but the
but of all the amino acids, you know, the enzymes that phosphate,
yeah,
phosphorylate the protein is done at that amino acid position.
Right. Tyrosine is one phosphorylation, and another phosphorylation takes place in serine, this OH, or threonine, this OH.
Right, so that's what we talked about, the enzymes that do phosphorylation. Because phosphorylation came up yesterday as part of the signaling cascade.
That's right.
Every enzyme phosphorylates another protein, which becomes another enzyme, and it's these three amino acid side chains, none of the others, that are available now for phosphorylation. So when you look for a phosphorylation site and a negative charge on a protein, it's going to happen in these amino acids.
Right. And
is there any significance to some of them having a salt ring?
Yes. And you probably heard sometime downstream today.
Okay.
Yes. And it's important for probably you. Somehow, I can tell you that. Each amino acid, because of the charge or extra this carbonic residue or amino residue and such, it takes unique shape of the charges according to change in pH. This is glycine, very simple amino acid, and has one. This is one not in the protein. This is a free amino acid, and isoelectric point and others, and total isoelectric point comes to about 6 in the glycine. That's why you use tris glycine buffer for many use, a little bit acidic. And on the other hand, you have extra charge of glutamate or extra charge in the histidine. Now this bumps comes not to just to 2 places, but to 3 places.
Excuse me. For the non-chemist expert, can you just say what you're plotting there and what I'm learning from?
Here, with the changing linear pH, that the stable area of the pH here, for instance, this glycine, held on a particular shape and charges. So Now glycine loses this positive charge.
Oh, I don't understand. The vertical axis is the pH. I know what the pH is.
Okay.
What's the horizontal axis? What is an OH minus equivalent?
This is one or two these adding charges. Here's the OH, if you can hydrolyze or you can, yeah.
Down, it measures the charge of the protein.
Right, right.
So you're plotting what's the charge of the protein?
Here's in the middle, the yes, and this is just this is arbitrary one, is middle one. And half of about.
Okay, that's fine, but what I'm seeing there is the charge of the protein as a function of pH.
That's right. Here is
the
right. And that takes place in, the problem is that does not take place, for instance, uniformly or symmetrically in some amino acid. For instance, here, glutamate goes this way from here, mostly. Negatively charged form to mostly positive charge, and where you sit here in the PI, where is the PI? Here, somewhere over here, glutamate or histidine. So I have that picture somewhere here. Yes. Why I showed you this, very boring things. What importance is this in biology or protein is adding different amino acids and you make total isoelectric points of the proteins. So you have a lot of positively charged protein amino acids incorporated to the protein or negatively charged amino acid into the protein, and the poisonous pepsin, which works best in your, you know, stomach. That PI is very low. I optimize the point, every point is very low. When there's lysozyme, is very high. So a cytochrome C one size facing pretty alkaline conditions. And most of the protein ranges in somewhere between, let's say, 5, 9, mostly in the 8 to 7 point something range, what we call neutral pH. And this is another thing, a little common problems. If you place these and many proteins in pH solution buffer in this isoelectric point. Protein loses charges, of course, it's neutral of this. So many proteins, especially if you have a high concentration, start to get precipitated, become insoluble, and start to get precipitated. That is one of the classical techniques to isolate proteins from among the other proteins in the solutions. But also may not work. In other words, some proteins fail to function because it's not enough charges, not enough hydrogen bond even. So protein, especially enzymes, sometimes fail to work. So just that is a little bit of good part and the bad part of this in practical usage of this for isolated point. And here's 20 amino acid list, different amino acids what we use. And as I said, lysine is K. Where is the K in lysine? Or Q, or W. Some letters are not there at all, but we use this for symbols, amino acid symbols. And the other important thing here, remember the hydropathy plot, and I showed you on the alpha helix transmembrane domain of hydropathy plot. I have it again, showing you that showing whether it's hydrophobic or hydrophilic of this region of the protein showing the plaque. And individual amino acid is assigned on this hydropathy index. Some is negative, some is very highly negative, means it's very hydrophilic. And high numbers, positive numbers, these are hydrophobic amino acids. So that comes in sometime later, just to remind you this. And that hydropathy plot, simply just plot of these numbers next to each other on linear scale.
That last column there, occurrence in proteins, that's
you know, about the average, you know, I don't remember what kind of proteins on this data, but so it's about, I don't remember what it is.
Wouldn't
that
be different from organism to organism? Organism
to organism is proteins. That's what I told you in this previous slide. But comes all together, it's not, you know, I think at the point it's not that much big deal, the difference, 10% difference from one amino acid to the other amino acids. Here are the two, well, smaller size proteins. One is cytochrome C and the other is chymotrypsinogen. And as you see, composition of the amino acid is quite different. It's three more times alanine, it is twice, of course, but the, here, variant, there are that many difference on variant usage or serine usage. So some protein uses a lot of one kind of amino acid or the others. But the last column shows probably if you collect all the enough samples of the proteins to do the statistics, it's probably is not that much big deal of the difference.
Isn't most protein
in
the world collagen?
Yes and no. That's what extracellular matrix people say.
There are lots of collagen, so there are several.
But isn't their composition similar?
All depending on the, you know, interest. So, just to remind you that the where the amino acids are coming from. All the amino acids are coming in somewhere in the step of the glycolysis or citric acid cycle. And amino transferase transfer amine residues into these intermediate of these metabolic pathways to make amino acids. The problem is some reaction is slow or taking a lot of energy or a lot of extra effort to make it. So here, that you've learned that the essential amino acids you heard on all these nutrients and such. Theoretically speaking, you have all these enzymes. You can make 20 amino acids, all amino acids. However, practically speaking, it's not you know, anywhere close to enough or efficient. So you have to take some amino acids. Of course, bacteria, yeast, or most of the plants can make all these 20 amino acids. So that's a matter of the efficiency. And as you know, some of these conditionally essential amino acids, you know, when you're juvenile, you have to eat more, for instance. So that requirement and the enzymatic efficiency determines this your, you know, essential amino acids or not, depending on species, depending on the age. And, well, that's boring part of this protein structure to me. But now we are going to a little more in the structure part. And as I said, that we always spell the protein amino acid sequence in the polypeptide chain from amino terminal end or N terminal end to carboxy terminal end or C terminal end, what we call, and like this. And that corresponds to genomic sequence of this nucleotide sequence from 5' end to 3' end. So we always have one way of reading it.
Is that the direction in which it is also synthesized?
Yes. That's you're gonna see in the next session, yes. Chemical synthesis, you may be able to make either side, but the in biological protein synthesis always from amino terminal on down. And primary structure of aminas, the protein is boiled down to this. It's called condensation of two alpha amino acids into dipeptide. Here, removing the water of this carbonyl terminal and amino residues to make this backbone. This is what we call the backbone. This C, alpha carbon, and this C connected to each other. These are what we call backbone, protein backbone.
It costs
a lot. And interesting part of this amino acid is, yes, I forgot to tell you this, is peptide bond. It's much stronger than the other weaker bonds, hydrogen bonds, either phosphoric interaction or ionic interactions. So this bond is very, very strong, number one. So hardest to break unless you use enzymes. And the second part is, or harsh conditions. And second part is, this is what I showed you here. This is COO, and this is NH. And here's alpha carbon, the one amino acid. And second amino acid, alpha carbon, the second amino acid. And this bond is prana. It does not have flexibility built in here, in these connections, when we first make it. So, this is prana, this is prana, this is prana, and this is prana. And if you fit everything in one single plane, it collides. It cannot make anything anymore. And that's primary adjusted by spinning the connections of between alpha carbon and amino residue, or alpha carbon, the carbonic residue within amino acid. So within amino acid, rotation takes place, not between two amino acid residues. Do you understand what I'm saying?
They
make a rigid reactions and this become prana.
No, hang on. The O, the C, and the N, they define what this blue plane is. But the C that sticks, the C alpha before and the C alpha after that, they both stick out of this plane.
Right.
So what do you mean by this on this planar?
No, this just this C and the N.
No, you can't say something is planar if you only have two points.
Well, what do you have? Side residues or oxygen and hydrogen sticking out. So this, with regards to this backbone and the angle of the oxygen, this oxygen and this hydrogen,
which hydrogen?
This hydrogen here, that defines brain.
Okay, okay. But that almost doesn't count because it's an infinitesimal thingy sitting on the end, size-wise.
You said so, but it comes to the point. Yes, it does, especially this oxygen. And so this is rigid and defined angle. So they adjust angles according within the amino acid. And also because of this R, depending on what, sometimes it's big, sometimes it's charges. So they have to adjust these angles according to all the circumstances around here. And what they do is to make this structure. So this is said to be, you can, you know, you can probably simulate it, but the simulation, but the said to be, what is this great spiral structure? They naturally make this. They sticking out this alpha residues, R residues of the amino acid, outward, away from each other, distant, most distance from each other to take. So most, ideally speaking, this is idealistic, too much idealistic alpha physics, but the idea is, biochemist idea is, try to make this different alphas as far as possible. So minimize these interactions. That creates these spirals for alpha helix. And because of, he said, this oxygen doesn't count, but this oxygen still hanging around here somewhere, and this oxygen here, and this hydrogen here, may still, in the angle, make a hydrogen bond.
I didn't say the oxygen doesn't come. I said the hydrogen, from a spatial point of view, is a very small thing on such an atom.
Yeah.
These collapse, these ones that you stick together, the hydrogen is typically always overemphasized in size. They're not nearly as big as you do.
Right. Not as big as, for instance, this owl could be much bigger than this. But the, and because of the distance and the such, this oxygen and the hydrogen coming together on like a 3D amino acids away in the spin. Yes. So it still counts. That's what, you know, I'm showing this in the past. And here's the another the problem before we go into the protein is, you know, oligopeptides. Nowadays, many people use oligopeptides for analysis or simulations and such. And oligopeptides, we are able to make chemically attaching alpha amino acids to each other. And in this case, they could go, as long as I know, if you're not carefully controlling the pH, if it goes either ways, binds either ways, rather than going one way of biological synthesis of proteins. And up to 15 peptides, oligopeptides, 15 amino acid chains, practically, cost measure-wise, is sort of pays to make this. Otherwise, bringing more than 15 peptides into the chain with the chemical reaction, you start to have difficulty separating one the other. And so many byproducts versus what you wanted, original amino acid sequence, is much less. So practically, I was told that I limit to 15 actually to make oligopeptides, because oligopeptides nowadays is very important for searching for neurotransmitters. Many, many small neurotransmitters, especially in brain, central nervous system, are peptides, small peptide hormones like this. So pharmaceutical companies and such do this to look for specific, you know, the drugs using this oligopeptide. And yes, that's the second part. And also catalytic core, or many binding core of these binding proteins or enzymes, are more or less like a 10-15 amino acid stretch. So you can make complementary charges or hydrophobic interaction or hydrogen bonding of the sequence of amino acid to make inhibitors, competing inhibitors. That's also very common in pharmaceutical companies. And lastly, this is what I do mostly, is to, in order to make an antibody, you inject antigen into rabbit or mouse. But it's very difficult sometimes to isolate proteins in the mouth, enough to inject it. So we just make the portion of that protein of interest and conjugate it with other very eccentric proteins like hemocyanin from people and inject into rabbits to make these antibodies. This is the smallest dipeptide useful probably. This NutraSweet is actually a modification of two amino acids that somehow your tongue is full to feel this is a sugar. And back to here. So ideally, when amino acids are subjected, most of the amino acids are subjected to the neutral pH, they started to this shape. It's called alpha helix. It's mostly right-handed helix. And spinning of about average of like 5 point some angstrom with 3 point some radius. And set mostly because there are like a 10%, depending on the proteins and such, 5-10% of the alpha helices actually exist in left-handed. And you can find within one protein, you have one portion, one alpha helices is left-handed, other alpha helices are right-handed. It happens. And theoretically, you should be able to make 50-50, but the nature somehow takes this much, prefers this. But unlike DNA or unlike this amino acid silk chemistry, left-handed alpha helices exist at that, not because of just weird organisms, exist in almost every protein.
Do your alpha helices
have the same pitch? No, I'm gonna show you that. And here, sometimes alpha helix is disturbed or become unstable or a little unwinded to make a little different pitches because here is a charges. For instance, this is one part of the troponin C alpha helix. And it's arginine astrogen coming in 3 amino acids away. Four amino acids has opposite charge. So it started to attract a little bit on discharges of the side residues, attract each other, and that adjusts the pitch a little bit. And obviously on the ionic bonding is pretty strong. However, if you have two same charges in that conditions, they start to repel, so they disturb. And also you have, for instance, on the phenylalanine or such, the big, side residues, amino acids next to each other, like this. Also, they're too big to be fit into small places, so they started to alert dispel each other. You know, it's making kink or something. Opposite is true. Glycine just has a side chain of hydrogen. It's too small and too flexible. And so it tends to disturb, or if you have a glycine, especially two glycines each other, it disturbs alpha helix. Because it fails to make stable structures. It's too flexible for just making secondary structures. And the proline is a problem. Proline here, I'm not chemist, so I'm not so good on this stereochemistry, but it flips around among these CN. And here's the next backbone. Here's backbone, protein backbone coming from this way or coming through this way. And this isomerization of the proline makes many cases this sharp turn of amino acid sequence. And this sharp turn then started to make another hydrogen bond among few amino acid away, among these two residues here. And also glycine, because it's too small, they also make better turn. And sometimes this kind of sharp turning takes place within the protein. Well, this is also one of the, what some people don't call this a secondary structure, but it's for better turns. Many other type of this turning, sharp turning of this amino acid sequence takes place. But proline, obviously, if you have a proline inside here, it fails to establish this sequence of the spiral. But most important things, what is important on this alpha helix is making backbone of many, many proteins. And especially, this is fibrous protein, keratin, your hair, or your nail proteins. And single keratin molecule on the middle, most of them, or middle of them, are alpha helix region. Alpha helix, long alpha helix. And that comes to each other to make coil to coil. And these dimers comes to each other to form protofilament. That accumulates to each other to make a bigger and bigger, bigger subunit, and to finally force us to make hairs. So alpha helix is pretty strong and uses for many, many uses, not only small portion of many globular proteins, but also it's important some of these fibrous proteins. Another alpha helix I showed you before is this transmembrane domain. And as you see here, the color of this color with amino acids are hydrophobic amino acid or non-polar amino acid. Here is hydrophilic amino acid, polar amino acid. Here, interestingly, it makes a little bit pocket of the hydrophilic amino acid or polar amino acid here, but mostly these are hydrophobic amino acids. That's why here bacteriodopsin, and I found a little better picture of this hydropathy probe. Now it strictly goes down here. And every time it goes through this, it corresponds to the color of this alpha helix. Hydrophobicity increases, like this, one, two. And then in between, this connection part is hydrophilic. And I found here, for instance here, 6 and 7. Actually, it just going very in the surface of this lipid bilayer, so it remained hydrophobic. It takes place. That's what that the hydropathy number is coming here. And you plot each numbers, each number of amino acid here plus that hydrophobicity numbers here, and then you get this graph. Another way of making this natural structure is the beta shift or beta conformation. Amino acid, this is not just one line of amino acid, but it comes and goes during these formations, and neighboring amino acid in separate strands start to make interactions to each other and start to make sheet structure. Also in this case, here, on side residues, interestingly, side residues are in the one plane, one level on the another level, and alternative, they expose this side radius this way, and the second level it's another side, and coming back this side, and this is unique among some of the proteins, has this extensive structure of this beta sheet. And obviously, it has to have amino acid dense enough to accommodate this alt. Alts are too big or charged, and such opposite charge, it fails to make it, of course. It does not align to each other. It could be parallel, it could be anti-parallel to each other. And this is called beta sheet. And sometimes, many times, it makes like this kind of ball structure, or we call it barrels. And this is one of the examples of the small protein called green fluorescent protein from jellyfish. Now, you know experimentally, we ligate this protein for markers, efflorescence, you know, and many variations of these proteins are found, depending on a little bit difference in configuration here, on chromophore here, and emits different light.
What does the N stand for in NRP?
What's M?
Yeah.
I don't know. This protein, I've never used it. I've never taken that as. Most of the alpha chain, alpha helix and the beta sheets are made used for this kind of structure, combination of it, to make structures like this actin here, beta strands here, alpha helixes here, and sort of defined or made structural sort of integrity that commonly seen in many proteins, and makes backbone of these proteins. And here's another example of the beta barrel. Some of the proteins called porins, aquaporins. I think aquaporins is a beta barrel. Is that correct?
Hemolysin.
Hemolysin is there. And the porins is like this, and hemolysin is this. It's making sheets, so in between you create the channels. Unique on this helix or secondary structure is collagen. Collagen makes its own helix. It's called collagen triple helix, what it's called. And pitch and the way of this is different from alpha helix. And they accommodate it. Actually, you don't see this. Immediately, they start to make these triple strands, triple helix chains. And they all three chains each other to make these helices, like these complicated helices. And that's the basis of collagen in bulk of these proteins. So collagen helix is not alpha helix. That's only found in collagen. That's why we call collagen helix.
On that electron micrograph there, the cross striations correspond to what in the
What is this? Here's the head of the collagen molecules here, and the tail, and this makes striations. Where head is, starting to make accumulate and then start to make birefringence and start to make this.
Right,
and the structure called RASMO, software called RASMO, you're talking about?
Yeah, it's
CDC3 or something?
A CDC3, yes, a similar protein, actually.
But it's free, and you can get it right off of PubMed, and then you can look at various aspects, how the electron distribution is on the protein when it's electrically neutral, all kinds of things, and you can rotate the thing, you can look down the axis, down the helix.
Because of the molecular biologies and all these simulations and such, we have many, many proteins now in database, the NIH CDC database.
Yeah.
And this coordinate database file are all set now and uniformized. So the few softwares you can take on this RASMO, CDC, blah, blah, blah. And you take this software and put these numbers, data from database, and you can see the proteins. Structures. It connects with all these other strands and making up to, let's say, globulus proteins. And that is called tertiary structure. And the basics of the tertiary structure, in many cases, depending on ionic interactions of this one side of the chain to the other side of the chain, making ionic bonding, or hydrogen bonding. Very occasionally, Van der Waals interaction takes place, but problem is, Van der Waals radius is too small for binding two amino acids in the different chains. Before two chains probably takes place, ionic interactions or hydrogen bonds takes place. And another important interaction is called, well, this is not interaction, this is hydrophobic interactions, what they call, but actually water surrounds hydrophobic cluster of these molecules, so they cannot escape it and they keep in the shape. That's called what we call hydrophobic interaction. But these three interactions under non-covalent interactions are main sources, probably the main sources of protein shape, keeping protein in shape. And hydrogen bonding normally takes two water molecules, but they can take, they have, more combinations, number one. And also, this, I never thought of this carefully on the energy basis. And this angle, how much is degrees fed. But this angle of this hydrogen bonding makes such a difference in strength when this made. So that's another important thing. This is stereotypical picture of this, what is hydrophobic interaction. Lipid bilayer, is disturbed, and then you take out one lipid into the solution, and this hydrophobic region of this phospholipid is surrounded by shell of the waters. This, and now you put two, three lipids together. These hydrophobic area get together and surrounded by water shell. Finally, if you have many enough, you make micelles, and they cross in the hydrophobic regions, cross inside into it. This is lipid. However, protein also makes this hydrophobic core. and the many, especially many, many globular proteins. Protein number one, also surrounded by water molecules, and most likely many of the surface amino acids are polar amino acids, polar, either polar charged or polar uncharged. So water molecules are making hydrogen bonding. This is hemoglobin, and these, I believe, are water molecules added here. And not only outside, and many, many molecules have this crest or patch of the hydrophilic regions internally. And the water molecules, small amount of water molecules go in this and then stabilize this protein structure inside with this hydrogen bonding. This is inside, deep in here, in hemoglobin subunit. That's so the water makes very important functions for protein structure. How, on the other hand, this is another example. Myoglobin. Myoglobin is similar molecules as hemoglobin, and that's one of the water molecule I showed you is around here, I believe. But mostly, myoglobin, this backbone, hydrophobic amino acids are placed internally. So this blue are the hydrophobic side residues, side chains for amino acids. And so, just like micelle, but less than degree, but just like lipid micelle, saline waters outside makes the protein keep in shape. You don't see that much if you put the space filling water, but actually inside, there are many, many here. And this is what, you know, I wanted to emphasize because many people do, I know that they're mathematics now, people ask to help modeling of the proteins and such. And because of the so much of difficulties, you omit the water. But, yes?
Well, in actual biochemistry, in the X-ray diffraction pictures of the obtained, there's very little water.
Right, that's right, exactly, that's right.
So, not only are the modelers removing the water, the experimentalists are removing the water.
And crystalline, yes.
So that's probably because when you do the spectrum of the water, it's obvious.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. But you know, all the things that we know about proteins now are done in the absence of water, experimentally, theoretically. The next challenge in this whole field is to create models that include the water.
Right,
and
right.
The water. Mm-hmm. So, maybe you'll mention when you talk about this, we've started to dehydrate proteins very slowly in solvents that take away the water. And, we can partially dehydrate the protein. We'd like to know at what point myoglobin or hemoglobin stops working as an oxygen binding molecule.
Right, right.
Depending on that amount of water. So there's 1,800 water molecules for hemoglobin in its hydrated state. In the crystalline state, there's 180. And by just partially dehydrating in, say, a long chain alcohol, you can get down to about 1,000 molecules of protein. But anyway, that's going to be a big issue, I think, in, as we really start to understand protein function, including water in models and including water in experiments that measure
right.
some structure as well as properties. That's the key.
But you know what happens if you slightly dehydrate protein and you immerse the protein in lower water activity. The activity goes up because physiologically water activity is lower than in the solution that we use in the experiment. So you'll find most protein other than the one that depends for function and hydrophobic interaction, the activity will go on. When you stress them so much by drawing out the water like in the crystal, then the function goes, but you know that's irrelevant.
Yeah, sure.
So what's the question?
He was first. I just wanted to
is it true when they try to purify the protein, they start, you know, changing salt concentrations, and then, you know, start tagging it with metals, and somehow that will change the conformation, but when they purify it and get rid of all that, they'll go back to its natural conformation, or is there always, there's no guarantee that what you really have is...
As long as my experience says, is you have a good day or a bad day. Depending on proteins, but even given proteins, in the given, you know, salt precipitation and such, somehow you have bad day, you have good day.
Yeah.
Sometimes it comes back, sometimes don't.
But is it representative of the real thing? I mean, you can always get it purified, but then I'm just saying that, you know, you do all these things and then you try to undo it somehow so you get back to the net, or...
Well, that might be an example of certainty and uncertainty. And
or is that just when you meet a crystal art, grab your few papers, and you need to keep that in mind? Because, you know, they come out and say, we saw the structure of love.
Yeah,
but, right, I have the crystal, but then they have to do some things to get the crystal.
Sure.
So.
Yeah.
Yeah, but the amino acid structure and the backbone sequence, that's a very robust message in there. So
okay,
you're going to
so
get something very similar. The little difference, you know, that's when you leave that. You know, obviously, you have the naturation of the delicate enzymes, but. You know, we can certainly leave with you. Those things are going to fall back more of it.
So, only the, you know, that with that, these line of the events that I can comment on is at the beginning of these myosin head crystallization structures. And myosin head, as I showed you the first day, it works along actin filament, so it takes a lot of conformational changes with hydrolysis and such. And a Wisconsin group started to make, somehow just make, started to make crystals. And nobody believed it at the beginning, because how can you believe this one condition or the other, especially if water is reduced, removed and such. So he went miles and miles of the procedures devised to make whole kinds of different conditions, whole kinds of tricks, utilizing very exotic ions and such, even induce mutation within the myosin head to make crystals, and finally we convinced, okay. And just this one condition making crystals, because it made crystals, you're right, maybe not, you know. And it does not come back. That happens to me too, isolating some proteins. So here's the related issues, yes. It's called Leventhal's paradox. It takes a lot of time to make these shapes. If you think these individual connections making natural secondary structure, it takes too long. That's what, you know, as long as I know, it's Leventhal's paradox. He started, finally, it's a famous paradox. He associated with his name on it. And somehow, all this one-by-one sequential configuration change does not take place, but randomly here and there, they're always changing, and also hydrophobic residues start to make solar accumulation inside of, in clusters, in the localized portion of the protein. What we call this is molten glob, the people call molten glob. That's not exactly final shape of these proteins, but the sort of accumulation of hydrophobic regions making closer to each other for next step towards final structures. But to be honest with you, we don't know how protein really makes this tertiary shape. And also, this is a few years ago, I know already, but people did the simulation of folding of this 36 residues, part of the villain, protein villain. And theoretically, it takes only 1 microsecond or so to make these 2-3 small alpha helices here. And but if they included 3,000 water molecules, put in the box, put in this, and do one by one interaction as iterations and steps, it took months and months with two great computers. So in other words, at this moment, with this, you know, just with this very fundamental algorithm you employ, it's almost impossible to predict protein structure from amino acid sequences.
I mean, that's a point that we were just talking about this morning. I got up at 5 o'clock this morning to talk with the National Academy of Sciences Committee on Biomolecular Materials. And one of the points that they made from previous reports was that the theoretical side of biology is lagging so far behind the experimental evidence now.
Right. Right, and this is, you know, probably alternative way of saying this, maybe this quote-unquote intelligent design takes place here, or we just can't, haven't been able to crack this intelligent design purpose.
Well, intelligent design might be in the thermodynamics.
Yeah, but the nature makes it always in good speed, so.
Sometimes not, it depends if there's a why in the day.
Right. So maybe that the overall, as he said, there is this big strategy of how to do this in computer science and such,
it's
and the physicists and everybody has to get together.
It's a national priority.
Right, because that leads to drug discovery to every single thing.
I once actually heard that it's a surprisingly large fraction of proteins which even in nature misfolded immediately again have to get rid of, because this doesn't.
Right.
You know what that fraction is?
I don't know, but the protein, you know, on the second lecture is about the key point is protein synthesis and assembly is just, you know, trial and error, and a big portion of these mismade proteins exist, and they all degraded. And I think in Nebraska we also involved. What is called amyloid proteins,
yeah.
That's accumulations that leads to many diseases. That's one of the misfolding, and this is the counterpart of inclusion body in bacteria.
Right,
prions too. Yes. Right. And also, you know, this is internal secret or whatever, because nobody has got enough to report it. But I study tubulin, okay? Tubulin cannot be folded without chaperone assistance, another protein mechanism. But tubulin structure breaks very easily. In vitro, it happens all the time, so half-life is so short. But in nature, broken down structure of the tubulin is sent back to the chaperone system. And in the cell, they fix it, try to reuse this polypeptide structure. And many times, they're successfully fixing it. Try like a few times before it gives up, and then put into the degradation pathways. And probably many, many proteins also are subject to that way, too. So we have this kind of thing is largely, specialists kind of knew it, but not enough evidence or deep or to convince enough to other people to document and make paper. But it takes place. We know it. So, yes.
Just an engineering question. First, why you call that a paradox? Because it seems to me it's something like an assumption or proposal. You know, it doesn't lead something that might be contradictory, right? So why you use the word paradox?
Because just with this random, if you think it's a random reactions, one by one cascade,
mm-hmm.
and theoreticals, time, you know, like ten nanosec, 100 nanosec of all this worried molecule hydrogen bonding takes place and such. If you put this in account sequentially, and the consequence of feeding back, that itself, as long as I understand this paradox, is it all accumulation this. It takes too much time than what proteins appear to be made, or structures appear to be made.
Yeah, but I agree with him that the word is a rather bad one, because it's only paradoxical if you make a very silly assumption right from the start. That
right.
In 1968, people knew that this can possibly be random.
I have another question, which because I don't know about that protein very much.
Mm. Misfolding.
So what does that misfolding come from? Like?
Misfolding means that they're taking alternative shape. Protein does not take what we think is physiological, or what we think in terms of a human view, right thing. Right, exactly.
It's a minimum it's not the minimum nature prefers, but something else.
Right. Could be, you know, actually physiological is a state of the protein or functional state of protein may not be necessarily minimum in energy.
Yeah.
Free energy form. So it may go into the worst case that's a protein accumulation actually. Of this amyloid protein and such are indeed lower in, you know, a more stable form. So,
isn't a prion quite stable?
Prion says to be quite stable.
Yeah.
Prion is another problem because not only the stability, but it has some magical natures on it. So,
right, it's a seed, like a seed crystal seed.
Right, yeah. Okay.